Shively had given you would have been to include any other additional potential bidders.
I believe in the answer to that question, and we can ferret it out a little further. I don't know if Mr. Shively knew whether or not there were one bidder, two, or three in the smaller zone that he'd drawn, whether or not, I didn't know that particular condition. No market survey had been conducted yet. Previous to that time, had expressed to him, and it was also in the memorandum, that any new construction would certainly be precluded. And also, the substance of the discussion with Mr. Shively at the time was that he understood the need for inclusion of the state office building. The recommendation was made that he go to the larger boundary in number two was because that included the state office building. I think the reason for the market survey was that we still didn't have a complete answer as to what would happen.
Right. Well, let me ask the question again about what you knew about the state of Mr. Shively's knowledge by asking the question this way. Did Mr. Shively say anything to you in that conversation to indicate that he knew that the effect of adopting your recommendation would be to continue to limit the available potential bidder to the Fifth Avenue Center?
No, but he never made any indication. I think this is important. I didn't know. He gave me a set of boundaries, and he desired that all be accomplished by July the 1st. Now, whether he himself knew what the effect of that would be at that time, I'm not going to comment on.
I understand, but let's move on a bit. Would it surprise you to know or to learn that Mr. Shively testified on pages 2239 to 40 and 2262 to 63 that, in fact, he did approve your recommendation before talking to Mr. Arsenault and before learning what effect, if any, adoption of your recommendation rather than Mr. Arsenault's would have?
I would have to say that I'm neutral on the subject.
Wouldn't surprise you because it's a matter of indifference to you.
To me, yes.
Yes. Let's turn now to the RFP itself, the draft RFP. I assume it went through prior drafts before the one that we have as Exhibit 11. Is that correct?
On
Exhibit 11, page 32. That's the page I'd like you to read from. The exhibit begins on page 29. That's the RFP dated September 24.
Mm-hmm.
Did it go through any prior drafts before this stage?
It may have gone through prior drafts. I only remember the one that was sent to me.
Okay. Would you read to us from page 32 the language that you and the Deputy Chief Counsel, Mr. Hamilton, discussed this afternoon?
The date of occupancy.
Date of occupancy, paragraph 3.
Not earlier than July 1, 1985, / not later than January 1, 1986. Bidders shall indicate date of guaranteed occupancy in the space provided in the bid schedule. The date of occupancy may be a factor in the award of the bid. If phased occupancy is offered, it may be considered in units of 19,000 square feet and in 9,000 square feet.
Do I recall correctly that you had a colloquy this afternoon with Mr. Hamilton about the sentence, quote, the date of occupancy may be a factor in the award of the bid, close quote?
We discussed the issue.
Indeed, it was an attempt to see whether a memorandum dated October 2nd from Commissioner Rudd, which was apparently was drafted on September 25, is that your recollection?
Yes.
Whether that language about the state expecting occupancy to begin on July 1st was consistent or inconsistent with this language. You recall that?
Yes.
Colloquy? I know you testified, Mr. Stock, that this sentence didn't mean anything in particular about the July 1st date, other than that that was an eligible beginning period. But it says, members of the Senate can draw their own inferences, of course, that date of occupancy may be a factor in the award of the bid. Now, could that mean the earlier the better? That's one possible meaning. Let me make it a little bit less hypothetical. Let's assume there were two bidders, identical space, identical quality of building, identical price, and identical impact on existing leases. One bidder offered occupancy on July 1st and the other of 1984, and the other January 1st, 85, 86. In your opinion, as an official responsible for this document, did that authorize the state of Alaska to prefer the earlier bidder?
Let me answer you the question in this way. It might have, but not necessarily would have, for the following reasons. By that time, by the time we had the response to this bid, we might have a better idea, since we were in the middle of a budgetary process, as to whether or not we were even going to get that far.
Of course, the fiscal year, as I understand it, begins on July 1st.
It begins on July 1st, however.
And the legislature adjourns when?
And the legislature adjourns, well, it adjourns now in May, just before that. However,
I apologize for interrupting. Please continue.
No problem. The problem here is that we might, for instance, if we leave ourselves the maximum amount of flexibility, I mean, that is my interpretation of what we were doing here. We might be in a situation where a bidder says to us, depending on how their price came out, I mean, this person might wind up with a higher price for this consolidation than we have previously budgeted. And that individual may come up with 32,000 square feet or 30,000 square feet on October the 1st. And another bidder says, well, we have 30,000 square feet on July 1. We might, by that time we got the bid, already have an idea that, well, there's no way we're going to get the money available by July 1, that the only way we can convince them to go for it is to only have 9 months' worth at that time for the additional increment. So therefore, we might prefer the October 1. It is entirely possible also that we might elect to do July 1 because we had sufficient funds to do that. So, you know, you're in a gray area. I guess the answer to your question is, as far as I can answer it, is yes and no.
All right. Would it be fair to say that someone reading this document would conclude that, according to the draftsmanship of the Department of Administration, timing was a relevant consideration in whether to accept a particular bidder?
It could be a relevant consideration.
Let's move along to the two changes that you discussed with John Shively on October 2nd. I believe you testified this afternoon that although they were presented to you in form as requests, please look into this is what I'd like to have, or words to that effect, you said in answer to Mr. Hamilton's question that you understood these to be instructions.
Yes.
Is that correct? Both with respect to the boundaries and the timing.
Yes.
But is it a fact that the next day you felt free to write to John Shively recommending against the instruction to change the boundaries and to urge him to reject what turned out to be Mr. Arsenault's proposal and instead to accept the Department of Administration counterproposal?
Okay, I want to separate out the word of, you know, Mr. Arsenault's proposal.
You didn't know that. That's why I say what
that
turned out to be.
And I'm tuning that part
right
of the question.
As far as you know, John Shively, locked in his room, decided that he wanted to have July 1st as the occupancy date, and he wanted to have what we've described as Zone 4 as the relevant boundary for an RFP. And you said you understood him on October 2nd to instruct you to make those changes, and the following day you said, John, let's not, with respect to the boundaries, let's do it this way instead. And he, the following day after that, and I represent to you that the testimony would show, without knowing what the effect of accepting your suggestion would be, said, you're right, Anselm, let's do it your way. Do you have reason to believe, I don't know what the answer is, I'm interested, that if you had come back and said, John, I think we'd be making a serious mistake, the state's interests would be disserved by simply insisting on a July 1st date rather than a phased occupancy date, that he would have said, I don't care. And if you
have... Can you repeat the question?
Yes. Do you have a basis to believe that if you had come back to John Shively on October 3rd, or any time before a sole source contract was let, and said, John, we should not specify a July 1st date as an absolute requirement because it would disserve the state's interests, would he have rejected that recommendation out of hand and said, I want it, no further discussion?
We had already had a discussion as to whether or not July 1st would cause problems. He was already aware, and we had had that discussion together, as to whether or not we would have a double leasing problem.
Let me interrupt. You had investigated that question immediately, yes, and ascertained what?
I had ascertained that was not a particular problem in terms of cost. I did also ascertain that it would prevent new construction. That is a bit of knowledge that he knew. And so there was no particular reason to mention that. I mean, he was making this decision, as far as I was concerned, based upon input. That particular question had been decided upon.
All right. Let's turn to that now. I think we're now getting down to some other subjects that are of interest. What's the practical effect of these changes? There has been hanging in the air some assumption that as a result of the two changes that we've been talking about for the last few minutes, competition was eliminated. Is that a fair statement of the assumption?
Yes.
Let's see how well that holds up under analysis. Let's turn, for example, to Mr. Peterson's memorandum of October 5, which you asked him to prepare as a result of Mr. Shively's conversations with you. Exhibit 14, page 37. Am I correct that you prepared this as a result, you asked Mr. Peterson to prepare it as a result of Mr. Shively's suggestions so that you and your department would know what the effect of these two changes would be? Zone 1, this is the first indented paragraph. Zone 1 is the original boundary used in the draft RFP. Is that correct?
Yes.
It says if you use the July 1st date, there'd only be two responses. If you go to the second zone, which you considered, still with the July 1st date, would provide two responses to the invitation or the RFP. Then it says if you use the same dates but use the zone that you recommended and Mr. Shively adopted, you'd be down to one eligible bidder and there'd be no point in having an RFP rather than a sole source. So what we're talking about here, putting aside or assuming for the moment a July 1st date, two bidders rather than one. One of these is the Fifth Avenue Center. Do you have any knowledge who the other supposed competitor was going to be?
No.
Do you have any reason to believe that there was, in fact, a real potential bidder out there?
No. I based whatever decision I have solely upon the fact that they said that there would have been two responses.
Mr. Peterson said, would it surprise you in light of the conclusion that you have drawn to know that there is testimony from the person who allegedly, according to Mr. Peterson, was going to be the other bidder, and this is a rough paraphrase of testimony of Greg Link, pages 1400 to 02, 1403 to 04, and 1421, that he, Mr. Link, had told the person whom Mr. Peterson called, a broker by the name of Brown, to ascertain whether he would be interested in bidding on the state's project, that at the time, October, indeed the end of September, he had a hole in the ground with thoughts of building a building that would accommodate 8,000 feet of office space, couldn't accommodate a building bigger than 10,000 square feet. The only way he could possibly bid on this office consolidation project was to find another site and perhaps buy it. And he said, because of problems he'd had in some other public projects recently, getting frustrated, he would not, quote, have seriously considered, close quote, getting into this project.
Excuse me,
Mr. You aware of that?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if Mr. Stark understood that question, but I didn't.
Let me rephrase it. Let's assume for a minute that... Let's assume for a minute... I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, if that's an objection, I'll...
The deputy counsel raised an objection, and you said you'd restate the question.
I'll be happy to restate
the
question.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir, of course.
Okay.
I mean, it's up to the chairman.
Can we do it?
Chairman.
Okay, let me try to get there if I can. My way.
Can we object?
You are either trying to assert or making the case, or trying to make the case, that the individual you're talking about, the 8,000 square feet or 10,000 square feet, is the second response that Mr. Peterson is talking about in here, that is the same response.
Yeah, I'm asking you to assume that that is correct, and I will leave it to the committee to determine whether or not the evidence bears that out. And of course, we can and will direct the committee to the evidence. I've just cited what I think are the relevant transcript pages of Mr. Link's testimony. We do have other testimony that would substantiate that. But assume with me, for the moment, that the person who, in Mr. Peterson's mind, was the other potential bidder, other than the owner of the Fifth Avenue Center, actually testified that what he told the people conducting this survey was that he could, theoretically, assemble a site if he bought another piece of land, but he would not seriously have considered doing so in response to the state's invitation to bid. If you assume that to be the case, would that have affected your judgment that there were two responses that would have been provided, as this memo says, if the original zone had been retained?
My answer to that question is, and I don't know if it will fully answer yours, and if it doesn't, you'll get to it. If I assume all of that, and I have all that knowledge, and I have the same knowledge that you have in there, and that knowledge is written down in here and provided to me, that's an entirely different situation than what is written here.
Right. I understand that.
It is not relevant to me or relevant to the case, as far as I'm concerned, as to whether or not that is, whether or not that's what Peterson thought the second response was. As far as I'm concerned, the decisions that were made were based upon what was in the memorandum, not whether or not the second response was something else. Now, I think what you're trying to say is that what Mr. Peterson indicated as a second response really wasn't the second response, and that no matter what happened, even if we had chosen Zone 1 or Zone 2, we would have wound up at the same building. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly where my line of questioning was attempting to go, and I think you've summed it up as well as I could have. So let's move on to another.
Mr. Nakabar.
Yes, sir.
It's close to 9 o'clock, and I asked how long you're going to be to finish it. Say, if you're going to go on for a while, we'll come back.
I'm afraid, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be a while.
Come back tomorrow. We have a couple of housekeeping measures first before we adjourn this evening. The Sergeant-at-Arms has requested that all senators stack their papers up in front of them because they're beginning to bend into each other and they don't know who belongs to what. Senator Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, statement of Governor Bill Sheffield to investigators dated 4-22-84, I move that it be submitted to the record.
No objections so ordered.
Statement of Lisa Rudd to the investigators dated 4-15-85, I move that it be submitted to the record.
No objections so ordered. Senator Sackett.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the courtesy of allowing me just a moment to make a request. I was going to do this yesterday, but again, we went quite late yesterday, so I didn't have the opportunity. I have four requests that I would like to make of the Rules Committee. Four witnesses to come before the committee, and I would like to have you please consider this. Pursuant to Alaska Statute 2425010 relating to subpoena powers of the legislature, and in keeping with my efforts and those of others to secure as much pertinent information as possible concerning the impeachment proceedings, I am requesting the committee to request or subpoena the original draft grand jury report as prepared and submitted to the grand jury by the prosecutors. In volume 11 of the transcript of the grand jury proceedings, the prosecutors explained to the grand jury that, quote, a grand jury report is very rare. It's an unusual event, unquote. Report, page 2615. Reference is made by Mr. Frampton of a, quote, draft that we've prepared for you, unquote. Report, page 2616. In several other passages in the transcript, reference is made to the draft report prepared by the prosecutors and submitted to the grand jury for their consideration. Those references are found on pages 2617, 2619, 2624, 2635, and 2636. I believe it would be in the interest of both the members of the Senate and the general public during these impeachment deliberations to review the draft report as compared with the final report issued by the grand jury on July 1st of 1985. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman, and I won't read the letters, I'll just submit them to you. In the interest of information for the senators and for the public, I would also like to request that you make a request or subpoena Mr. Cliff Groh, Mary Lou Madden, Avram Gross, and Susan Burke so that they can come before the committee and give us their information that they have with regard to their findings and the reasons that they feel that the conclusions that they had reached with regard to their research that they had done. With regard to the request I have for Mary Lou Madden, who is the foreperson of the grand jury, I ask that she be subpoenaed to appear because the grand jury, following their inquiry, concluded that the Sheffield administration has not best served the interests of the public and is unfit to fulfill the inherent duties of public office. That's in report page 2. The grand jury further recommended that the legislature be called into special session so that the Alaska Senate may consider the evidence presented to and the findings of the grand jury for the express purpose of initiating impeachment procedures against Governor William Sheffield. Given the seriousness of the grand jury findings and the recommendations, and in concert with the Rules Committee decision of Tuesday, July 23rd, 1985, by a vote of 4-1, not to limit the scope of the committee hearings, I believe it is vital that the Senate learn all it can as to how the grand jury arrived at their conclusions. We need to know what standards were used by the grand jury to conclude that impeachment should be considered. Just as the grand jury sought to hear all the evidence before making their conclusions, I believe it's paramount the Senate ask to learn all it can, not only of the administration's conduct in this matter, but also to fully understand how the grand jury arrived at their recommendations. The people of Alaska have a right to know. To do anything less would, in my view, be an affront to the people and an abridgment of our obligation to uphold the public trust in the discharge of our duties. These I'll make available to you at this present time.
Thank you very much.
I should point out that the Rules Committee did limit the scope of the impeachment inquiry to matters referred to the Senate by the grand jury in its July 1st, 1985 report. What we didn't do by the vote of 4-1 was further narrow that
impeachable offense in its scope just simply to the perjury question. However, the chair will take your request under advisement,
yes,
and we'll give you an answer to
all of these. The requests that I have with regard, for example, to Ms. Madden is from the transcripts that we are working from, and that's why I felt it was a part of the area that you had allowed.
Senator, we'll give you the answer tomorrow. Rules Committee adjourned until Friday, July 26th at 1:30 p.m.